to episode 106 of Beyond Barbarossa, the first English-language podcast in the world to focus on the Eastern Front of World War II. I'm Scott Burry, podcasting from the Redbeard Studio on the unceded territory of the Anishinaabeg Algonquin people, also called Ottawa, Canada. And I'm joined in the Redbeard Studio today by Ragnar the Magnificent, the indispensable ragdoll cat. Say hello, Ragnar. Before I get to the episode, a quick reminder that you can help me keep this podcast going through patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa. Until Russia ends its unprovoked aggression in Ukraine, proceeds will go to charities that help refugees. Now, on to the episode. Episode number 105 described the declarations and decisions made at the Potsdam Conference. These decisions set up much of the world order for the next half century. The conference ended on 2nd August 1945. But the Second World War was not over on that day. You know what I mean. On Monday, 6th August 1945, US B-29 Super Fortress Enola Gay dropped Little Boy on the city of Hiroshima, Japan. The second nuclear detonation in history leveled the city, destroying 70% of the buildings and immediately killing over 70,000 people. As many as another 50,000 would later die of injury and radiation. 1 week later, on 9th August, a second American superfortress, the Boxcar, dropped the third atomic bomb, the Fat Man, on Nagasaki, killing another 35,000 people. With this second bombing, Japanese Emperor Hirohito prevailed upon the war cabinet to surrender unconditionally to the Allies. Well, almost unconditionally. The only condition, which all sides agreed wasn't really a condition, is that the monarchy would remain. Unlike in Germany, where the terms of surrender meant complete elimination of the form of government. Ever since the atomic bombings, there's been a debate on their necessity. Japan, it has been argued, was on the brink of collapse by August 1945 with ammunition, food, and fuel shortages, the loss of nearly all their experienced pilots, the loss of most of their navy, including their flagship battleship, the Yamato. Air raids in 1945 were burning key cities. And by the summer of 1945, there were several people in the government advocating a surrender. But until 9th August, the hawks in the war cabinet seemed to have more sway and develop plans for defense on the beaches if the Americans and other allies invaded. These plans for defense on the beaches, including arming civilians with sharp bamboo spears. Not kidding. There were people on the Allied side who also argued that the atomic bombs were not necessary. The Americans were firebombing Japanese cities, including Tokyo. They had captured islands, including, at great cost, Okinawa, giving them naval and air bases for an invasion of the Japanese home islands. U.S. President Harry Truman wrestled with the question before authorizing the atomic bombings of two Japanese cities. He knew they would kill a great many civilians and agonize over the deaths of children, as evidenced by what he wrote in his journals and letters to his family. On the other hand, an amphibious invasion of Japan itself would mean the deaths of over 100,000 American soldiers, sailors, marines, and aviators. Even without an invasion, extending the war longer would cause more military and civilian casualties. And the firebombings, already going on, would also kill thousands of civilians, including children. In the end, Truman decided to authorize the bombings and demand unconditional surrender. Not only did the atomic bombings bring about Japanese surrender and the end of combat in the Second World War, it changed the nature of warfare and the world forever. After 2nd August 1945, everything would be different because the most powerful nation in the world had a weapon that could wipe out whole cities in a single strike. Nuclear weapons changed international relations. They brought about a new arms race that led to the real possibility of a war that could end civilization and perhaps even the human race. Mutually assured destruction became the strategy of the emerging competing superpowers. They also brought a new deadly dimension to another war that had started, I believe, before the Second World War ended, the conflict called the Cold War. I am very pleased to have a guest to talk about all of this, about the relative status of the opponents in the Pacific in 1945, about the condition of Japan, about the bombs, the cities, the Cold War, and much more. My guest today is James Scott, author of a brand new book, Empire of Ashes, Truman, Hirohito, and the Descent into Total War. Welcome, James Scott, to Beyond Barbarossa.
Thanks for having me on.
Your latest book, Empire of Ashes, as of time of recording, is it now available to the public?
It comes out tomorrow. So the fourth book's typically published on Tuesdays. So it'll be out tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. 4th of August. Okay.
Well, I was fortunate enough to be able to read an advance review copy.
I was very impressed by the book and by the level of detail. Your writing style, it's almost like a thriller, especially the descriptions and very detailed descriptions of the flights themselves of the Enola Gay and the boxcar, but also on the portraits that you wrote, that almost drew of Harry Truman and Emperor Hirohito. You know, I'd like to get into that a little bit, but before we do that, you've written a number of other books as well about the Second World War, mostly in the Pacific and against Japan. What draws you to that subject?
Yeah, so I kind of fell into it many, many years ago. My first job when I finished college was as a public school teacher in Japan. And this was, not to overly date myself, but this was back in the 1990s. And so I taught at a junior high school in a small town of about 19,000 people on the main island of Honshu. So I was about 3 hours west of Kobe. And so back that time in the 1990s, you know, there were still a lot of veterans from World War II around, civilians who'd experienced the war. I actually volunteered to teach at a local community center in my town. And at night, you know, it was a conversational English class. And so, we would get together at night and just have dialogue. And I remember my students telling me at the time about what it was like to be in Osaka during the fire raids. And of course, for me, I was like, I didn't even know much about it. I mean, I'd studied history in school, but we'd never really gotten into that granular depth of the air campaign like that. So it really sparked my interest. And then I went to visit Hiroshima in the spring of 1998 for the first time. And then I flew literally just within a couple of weeks after that to meet my parents in Hawaii. And first place we went to visit was Pearl Harbor. So literally in the span of just a couple of weeks, I sort of saw the bookends of America's experience in World War II. And it just something like a light bulb went off. It just sort of clicked, started reading about it, got interested in it. I finished up teaching. I ended up as a journalist for a little while. And then when I went back to school when I was about 30 and could see what's happening in the print business, as a newspaper reporter, decided I needed to kind of reinvent myself. And so I kind of went back, and my subject of interest, of course, was always World War II, was always the Pacific. And so I fortunately kind of made that segue into writing books at a good time, too, because there weren't as many journalists crowding into that field as there are today. So I've subsequently gone back to school. I did my master's in military history. I'm wrapping up my doctorate now. So, kind of how I came into it, sort of a roundabout way.
So soon I'll have to call you Dr. Scott.
No, you won't, but I'll at least have a couple of extra letters I can add on a business card, I guess.
Great. Well, as I said, I was very impressed with the book and the details and so on, and I was surprised to learn a number of things, especially about your main characters, President Truman and Emperor Hirohito. For example, that Senator Truman, so when he was a senator before he became vice president, uncovered through his senatorial duties into looking at the expenditures of the United States government, what turned out to be the Manhattan Project itself, and then figured out that after asking questions about it that maybe I better just let this one stay quiet. That really struck me. It's like, okay, this guy was not really considered at the same level as many of the other senators. He didn't have the college education. He was a child of farmers and the proprietor of a number of failed businesses. But he was smart enough to not only find this nugget, and then smart enough to say, okay, this is something I best leave alone. But also the way that he so quickly got into the role of being president after being kind of isolated almost by President Roosevelt. So that really impressed me. And then Hirohito also surprised me, because coming into reading this book and from everything I had learned, and I haven't delved deeply into the war in the Pacific, but you know, I always thought of Hirohito as basically a puppet of the military government. And then to see how he, spoiler alert, he was able to exert pressure on the war cabinet to sue for peace, despite the opposition against him or against this course of action. That was quite an informative step for me, which leads me to my question after all that. As in even August 1945, following the bombing and even to today, there are divided views on the necessity of the bomb in the United States, in the West generally. But what about in Japan today, or as recently as you know? Is there sort of a consensus on whether the bombings were necessary? What's the zeitgeist about that?
Yeah, so no, you know, I think it is a very complex subject about the use of the bombs there at the end. And there have been, you know, I actually write in the epilogue of the book, I mean, you look at the historiography of this topic. I mean, yes. The whether the bombs were necessary or not is probably the single most debated issue of the entirety of World War II. And of course, I think it really, at its heart, it's such a morally perplexing question and such a daunting decision that Truman faces. I mean, think about it. I mean, what other world leader is faced with this type of decision of, do I obliterate a city or do I not? I think in order to kind of get at the heart of whether it was right or wrong and how Americans view it and the Japanese view it, it's kind of important, I think, to look at it, pull that lens back a little bit and just look at the context of that time period when Truman makes that decision. Because it is so debated, and unfortunately, as it's been debated so much over the years, a lot of misinformation is out there. In fact, I got an email this weekend from somebody had read a review in the Wall Street Journal asking me one of the questions that, of course, is addressed in the book, but it just shows how these things are out there. And I think the question really comes down to, what is the difference between defeat and surrender?
That's an interesting question. Let's get into it after a short break.
Hi, Scott here. I hope you're enjoying this episode and that you get a lot out of the whole podcast. Beyond Barbarossa is still, as far as I can tell, the only English language podcast in the world that focuses on the Eastern Front of World War II. If you do like it and you want to help me keep it going, please give it a rating or a review on Apple, Google, Amazon, Podbean, or whatever podcasting platform you listen to it on. That helps let other people know about it. Patreon's another way you can support the podcast, my research, and podcasting expenses. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and sign up at whatever level of support you choose. Patreon supporters get early, ad-free access to new episodes, as well as exclusive bonus episodes on topics like the Winter War between the USSR and Finland and the pre-Barbarossa invasion of Poland by Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union in 1939. Check it out, won't you? Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa. Thanks.
Welcome to part 2 of episode 106 of Beyond Barbarossa. I'm joined by James Scott, author of Empire of Ashes, Truman, Hirohito, and the Descent into Total War. Before the break, James brought up an interesting question. For Japan in 1945, what was the difference between defeat and surrender? James, let's dive into that.
And that's at the heart of it all, and because Japan is largely militarily defeated. Not entirely, though. I mean, their navy pretty much is gone. It's at the bottom of the Pacific. Their air force is being converted into kamikazes. But they still have a very sizable army of about 5 million men under arms. And that army has not yet been defeated. And that army is based partly in China, but also in the homelands, home islands, and is being rapidly mobilized and pushed down to Kyushu, which is the southernmost Japanese island, because the Japanese see that's going to be the next invasion point for the Americans after Okinawa. So they're rapidly fortifying that in preparation for the American fight. Truman has already greenlit invasion of Kyushu, which is going to take place in November of 1945, to be followed in the spring of 46 by the invasion of Honshu, the main island. So the die has been cast that these two countries are about to come to blows on land. Now, what has happened as Japan has been moving its forces there is that they have changed their battlefield strategy very dramatically in the last year of the war. And a lot of people don't appreciate that or understand it, but Japanese military leaders understand that outright victory is not going to happen. What they're trying to avoid is unconditional surrender. And of course, that is one of the most popular slogans of World War II. It's a policy laid down by Truman's predecessor, FDR, in 1943 at the Casablanca Conference. And what it represents is an opportunity for allied nations to completely remake the Axis powers in the aftermath of the war. They want to go into Germany, rip out all the Nazi, roots of Nazism. They want to do the exact same thing in Japan. That's going to involve completely changing their governments. That's going to be involved going after their industries, their school curriculums. I mean, their social
very structure. Culture.
Very culture. And so it is a dramatic thing. And the Japanese are very adamant that they don't want that. They don't want to lose the monarchy, number one, but they also don't want an American occupation or allied occupation. They don't want the allies to be putting their officers on trial as war criminals. So what they're really doing is they are trying to, in that last year of the war, is create a bloodletting of the Americans in order to make the cost of victory so high for the Americans that the public is going to push back against fighting to the bitter end. And they do that in Manila, they do that on Iwo Jima, and they do that on Okinawa. And I use Iwo Jima as a good example because it's small. Iwo Jima, the battle takes place over 32 days in the spring of 1945. And I've been to the Iwo Jima, I've stood on the top of Mount Suribachi, which is, of course, where the famous flag raising was. Mm-hmm. If you look out across Iwo Jima, it is an 8-square-mile island. It's tiny. It'd be like looking out across Central Park, effectively. I mean, it's very, very small. You can walk from one end to the other in about an hour and a half. I've done it. And so that battle for that tiny piece of earth took 32 days and almost 50,000 casualties. Mm-hmm. It's the only battle of the Pacific War where the Americans suffered more casualties than the Japanese. We had 27,000 casualties, including 7,000 killed. Japanese had lost about 20,000 killed. So, I mean, it's a brutal, brutal fight. If you go back and you look at the media accounts, I mean, the beaches were covered with intestines and body parts and shrapnel. You go to that beach today, you pick up the sand, and it's just filled in your hands of just bits of metal and shrapnel. Oh. So that really kind of exemplified how good the Japanese were at defense. Mm-hmm. And they did the same thing on Okinawa. Okinawa was much, much bigger. I mean, just on Okinawa alone, we had 25,000 combat fatigue cases. I mean, it really gives you an idea of just how brutal this was.
The Battle of Okinawa, that was about 3 months long, right?
Yeah, it was over 80 days. So it was almost three times as long and over 100,000 civilian deaths. I mean, just absolutely brutal. And so then what you're seeing is you're sort of going up this escalatory ladder and you see that Kyushu is going to be a whole lot worse. And so what the Americans, what Truman is seeing at this point is he's seeing, oh my gosh, the Japanese, they're continuing to fight, continuing to have incredible resistance. Tactics are changing. American casualties are going through the roof. At the same time, he's hearing from parents. Letters are pouring into the War Department. Editorial pages are sounding off about how bad this is going to be. If we're really committed to unconditional surrender, how are we going to do this? And more importantly, how are we going to prevent this battle between these two countries that's going to lead to just this horrific casualties? And I mean, one Pentagon estimate in July 1945 was calling that, saying that the Americans could expect between 1.7 and 4 million casualties. And the Japanese were looking at 5 to 10 million. Yeah. So this is really, people don't realize that this final battle was shaping up to be just absolutely horrific at that point.
And also, it was around this point, early summer of 1945, when Hirohito was bringing the new ministers in, he said, we need one last victory before we can ask for peace.
Totally. And that was their whole goal. We need one win in order to rattle the Americans so that they don't have unconditional surrender. But the Americans were really worried about that, because even though we'd been fighting the Japanese, in addition to all these battles, we'd been burning their cities starting in March of 1945. We'd burned over 170 square miles out of 64 urban areas. There wasn't much left in the way of Japanese cities and industrial capability, and yet they continue to fight.
Right.
And fight. And so at this time is when the atomic bomb comes online, July 1945. And for the atomic bomb, in the eyes of the Americans, is not so much a weapon of destruction, because we've destroyed everything in Japan. Yeah. I mean, there's really the only reason Hiroshima and Nagasaki exist is because an order had gone out earlier that spring to protect these cities from a conventional raids, because America needed a fresh city in order to see the results of an atomic bomb. So then the atomic bomb comes on. It is seen not so much as a weapon of destruction, but one as a political weapon. Mm-hmm. And again, it gets back to the defeat and surrender are two different things. Defeat is the state of your battlefield, where you are on the battlefield. Surrender is a political decision.
Right.
Traditional bomb is a conventional weapon. Atomic bomb, in this case, was a political weapon. Mm. And what the U.S. was trying to do was to shock Japan's political body into surrender. And so that sort of sets the stage for where Truman is when he has to make that decision in July of 1945. How can we shock Japan off of its, national suicide path to fighting this war to the very last man? And there were certainly military leaders inside Japan that were willing to fight that far.
Yeah. And even after the second bomb fell, there was half the war council or war cabinet willing, and determined to keep fighting.
Exactly. And so that kind of shows, the whole idea of what the bombs necessary, they absolutely play a very instrumental role in shaping Japanese policy at the end of the war. Mm. Hands down, no doubt about it. The argument that Japan was already defeated, not 100% true, really. Yes, they're defeated in some ways. They still have a huge army. Right. They still got a whole lot of troops. They got a whole lot of fanatical troops, and they're really willing to fight to the end. And you've also have senior leaders willing to fight to the end. So I think that is kind of the view that Truman's coming out. Now, from the Japanese perspective, it's mixed. I think it's like every country, in that you have historians and individuals and organizations that understand the reality of World War II and what it was like, and the consequences and the stakes. And then you have people who don't. And I would compare it. I think the best comparison is to look at the American Civil War. I live in the heart of the Confederacy here in Charleston, South Carolina. The Civil War literally started about 2 miles from where I'm sitting right now out in Charleston Harbor with the bombing of Fort Sumter and the attack on Fort Sumter. Even today, you still have people arguing that, was it states' rights? Was it slavery? And there's this tug of war over history and narrative. And I think that's where we historians come in. You see that in Japan. You go to the Yusukan Museum in Tokyo, which is a private museum right there at the Asakuni Shrine. When you walk in, the first thing you see on display is the first railroad, the first locomotive that crossed the Tyburn Railway. It paints a portrait of World War II history in which Japan is a victim, and that it was the Americans that were the aggressors by cutting off oil, and that, the Rape of Nanking never happened, the atrocities never happened.
Oh, really?
Totally different view of war. And then you go down to Kyoto, which of course was the city that was ultimately spared from the atomic bomb. That was Leslie Groves' desired target initially. You go there and you have the Kyoto Museum of World Peace, and it tells the complete opposite view of history, which is that Japan was the aggressor, and that Japan was the architect of the East Asian co-prosperity sphere, and that the Rape of Nanking happened, and they have diaries on the display there. So I think that reality, it's never that easy to say, well, yes, they believe this or they believe Y, X or Y. What you see is that there is this constant tug of war that frankly takes place in a lot of societies. But I would say that the dominant view is that, yes, I mean, there's an understanding that Japan was the aggressor. Had they embraced that to the level of the Germans? No. But I take heart in the fact that all my books have been translated into Japanese. I go over there and I speak. I tapped in with a lot of the folks over there. And so I see that element of it. So I do think that, I mean, I love to go visit Japan. I was there twice this year already.
And it's only August. Okay.
Well, I guess technically I was there late last year. So twice within the span of the last year. So I'm there again this spring. So yeah.
That's amazing. Wow.
Yeah.
My listeners are, of course, interested in all aspects of the war. So I understood that this is something I didn't really fully appreciate before I read your book, is that the two bombs that were dropped, Little Boy and Fat Man, were different types of atomic mm-hmm. bombs.
Absolutely.
And so the first one to be dropped, the Little Boy, which was dropped over Hiroshima, that had never actually been fully tested, because the type of bomb that was tested at the Trinity test in New Mexico was the plutonium implosion bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And the Little Boy type, as was one time called, had never actually been detonated before. So how confident was Leslie Groves and the whole group that it would work?
Well, Leslie Groves never suffered from a lack of confidence, I should say. And I love Leslie Groves. I think he's one of the most fascinating figures of World War II. And he's a lot like Curtis LeMay in that he's an underappreciated figure. Now, of course, for your viewers who may not be all that familiar with him, he is Matt Damon's character in Oppenheimer.
Right.
And Groves would have loved the fact that Matt Damon played him, because he had a huge ego. Of course I'm going to have Hollywood's A-lister playing me. But the reality was, Groves was a much, much different man than Matt Damon. He was not Jason Bourne. He was a probably morbidly obese individual whose weight fluctuated between 250 and 300. He was an incredibly smart individual, a great engineer. He'd spent time at both MIT and West Point. He was probably one of the hardest working people in World War II. And he is really the reason the Manhattan Project works. Even though Oppenheimer gets the film, Groves does all the work. But let's be honest, who really wants to spend 3 hours watching a movie about an engineer who's really good at his job? Or you can watch one about a morally conflicted physicist. You know, it's like, from a framing standpoint, you could see the pitch session in Hollywood. Yeah. Like, I've got Bob the Builder, and he's really good at versus,
It's this complete nut job. But anyway. Yeah,
versus Christopher Lloyd here on from Back to the Future. You know, yeah. Very two different individuals. But uranium was a much easier fuel to work with, in that it was much more stable, so that when they knew very confidently that the gun mechanism, and basically what they did is they shot two pieces of uranium into one another. It was really effectively, imagine like three nuts in a bolt going in it like that.
Mm.
Effectively, that bringing the two pieces of uranium together triggered the sort of the chain reaction that set off the bomb. Plutonium, of course, you couldn't do it. You couldn't get them together fast enough, or it fizzled out, which in 1943 required a complete reworking of how they were going to trigger the bomb. And that's where they came up with the concept of the implosion mechanism, which was mm-hmm. basically wrap it with explosives, and then you just blow it inward on itself. It's like taking a grapefruit and squeezing it down to the size of a lime. That would trigger it. They weren't as confident in that, but they had more fuel. Plutonium is a lot easier to manufacture than uranium. So what it is the uranium, they would have to extract the certain type of isotopes that they needed,
right.
And it took a lot, lot longer. They simply didn't have enough fuel to test uranium. Either got a bomb or you got a test. And they had enough to have two plutonium bombs, which is why. And they were less confident. That's why they chose to test plutonium bomb.
Well, that helps clarify. And this is something that didn't really come up that clearly in the movie. So it's great to have that clarified. Now, this brings me to the focus of my program, which is the Eastern Front of World War II. And it's interesting, I think, that the USSR had agreed in Yalta to enter the war against Japan after a certain time, after the defeat of Germany. And they did that after Hiroshima, the day before the bombing of Nagasaki.
But let's get into that after another short break.
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe by Ukrainian princesses? Or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army? Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more about my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel. And all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and traditions. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net And now let's get back to Scott exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
Welcome back to this conversation with James Scott, author of Empire of Ashes, Truman, Hirohito, and the Descent into Total War. We've talked about the Second World War in the Pacific, the decision to use atomic bombs against Japan, and about the bomb technology. Now, let's turn to the focus of this discussion, the Soviet Union's role in the war. The USSR had agreed at the Yalta Conference in February 1945 to enter the war against Japan after Germany's defeat. The Red Army then invaded Japanese-occupied Manchuria on 8th August 1945, after the bombing of Hiroshima, one day before the bomb dropped on Nagasaki, and a week before Japan's surrender. But that's not to say that the Japanese decision to surrender was because of the Soviet Union's entry into the war, is it?
What was the impact then of the Japanese leadership and the people to learn that, yes, the USSR was entering the war against them?
That's one of those things I think that has been overplayed in history in the wake of the atomic bombs. You often hear people say, well, it's really the Russians that had the bigger influence on the Japanese deciding to surrender, not the atomic bombs. And that's kind of one of those sort of erroneous things that you've heard post-1945. It's important to remember why the Americans wanted Russia in the war, is that the Japanese had almost 1 million troops in Manchuria. Mm-hmm. And we were very worried that those troops were going to get on ships and go to Kyushu and back up there. And at Kyushu, we were going to be facing a huge number of Japanese. And as the summer of 1945 is going on, every new intelligence coming out of the Pacific just shows, wow, the Japanese have yet another division on Kyushu and another division on Kyushu. Like, their numbers were just going up. And so what we were hoping to have is we'd have three Americans coming ashore to battle every one Japanese, which is a ratio that you want in combat. Mm-hmm. But as the summer goes on, it goes from 3-1 to 3-2 to basically 1-1. And so now you're suddenly at a loss, an idea, which is not, that's not a recipe for victory. In fact, the Americans were having a meeting, scheduled to have a meeting on August 6, 1945, to decide whether or not Kyushu was still viable. Basically, mm-hmm. Were we going to have to abandon the whole Kyushu plan? Now, the reason Truman goes to Potsdam is his number one goal is, we got to hurry up and get the Russians in the war. And they needed the Russians to tie down those Japanese troops. We need those Japanese troops to stay there and not come interfere with Kyushu. And so as part of that, the Americans have been supplying the Russians with ships, with food, with underwear, all these kinds of things in order to help boost them up, because we knew that they weren't up to the level that they needed to be in order to really be a fighting force against the Japanese. So we were trying to help them get there. Mm-hmm. The Japanese knew this, hard not to see what was happening. The Americans were clearly helping them there. I think probably the biggest clue to the Japanese was when the Soviets decided not to re-up the neutrality agreement in April 1945. You know, of course, that's a pretty big clue right there. Yes, there is one sort of provision there that says, you know, if either side pulls out, you agree not to go to war for a year. I mean, who's really going to put a whole lot of faith in that?
Yeah.
I mean, you're clearly on a path to war at that point. So you've got that. And then, of course, the Japanese realize when they're trying to sort of, when Hirohito's trying to get some sort of peace envoy to try to negotiate a way out right before the atomic bombs, he, of course, is naturally going to go through Russia. He can't get Stalin to agree to even welcome his envoy to come. Yeah, the Russians are pushing back, being like, you don't need to come. We're good. Thanks. No need. And of course, you have Japan has its key diplomat there and writing back saying, look, clearly the Russians are working with the Americans and the English on this. This is just not happening. So, I mean, it's really the combination of all these things. Plus, of course, when Potsdam happens, you see all the media coverage shows the photos of the big three all sitting there. The Japanese would be foolish not to realize exactly what is going on there. Yeah. Russians are agreeing that they're no longer in the neutrality agreement. The Americans are sending them all sorts of supplies. They won't even let one of our envoys come over to talk to them. And now they're meeting in Europe. Hello. This idea is like, it's clear what is happening. And so I don't think it's a huge surprise to the Japanese when the Russians come in. I think they probably expected a little bit later than it was, but it wasn't a shock. And historians have subsequently tried to make that out to be, some of them have tried to make that out to be a bigger impact on Japanese decision-making than the atomic bombs. And that's simply not the case.
Right.
You look at what was said and hear what Hirohito said at the time. I mean, it clearly the bomb was the deciding factor.
Right. The other thing, just a little wrinkle to throw in there too, is that at Potsdam when it began on 26 July, Stalin already knew about the bomb.
Totally, yeah.
Because of his spies in the Manhattan Project and elsewhere. Truman was trying to be coy about it, but Stalin knew what was going on.
Exactly, exactly.
The invasion or the declaration of war from the USSR didn't really factor into Japan's decision, Hirohito's decision, and the rest of the people who wanted peace. But following that, what was the relationship immediately after 1945 between Japan and the USSR? What was that like?
From the American perspective, the view of relationship with the USSR very much was a factor in a lot of issues. And that even came down to where the bomb was going to be dropped. And by that, I mean that Leslie Groves was really adamant that the atomic bomb be used on Kyoto.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've watched the film Oppenheimer, one of the few mistakes that film has is it has the actor playing Henry Stenson saying that the reason he didn't want it bombed was because he had honeymooned there with his wife and it was a lovely city. And that's simply not true. Henry Stenson had actually gone on his honeymoon in the 1800s. I think he'd gone canoeing in like New Hampshire. He'd gone and visited Kyoto while he was in the Philippines as governor in the Philippines at the time. And so he did understand the value of Kyoto. And for anybody who's ever been, Kyoto is a lovely city. It's my favorite city in Japan. Yeah. And I love to visit there. In fact, I take tours to the Pacific for guests that want to study World War II. We always go to Kyoto and talk about the city that was saved. It has 2,000 temples. It's a beautiful city. It's low rise. It's got the hillside around it, the mountains. It's got the temples. And it's the castle. I mean, it's a really, really magical city to go and visit. And Stimson understood that value. And so too did Groves. But Stimson and Groves had two very different endpoints of their opinions. And Groves' endpoint was, I'm here to win the war. My job ends whenever Japan surrenders. That's my whole focus, is to put whatever pressure on Japan to bring it into the war. And he saw Kyoto as a perfect opportunity to test this new weapon. Because if this is going to be a political weapon, what better place to use it than a city filled with intellectuals and artists? And also, what better way to send a message to the Japanese of how horrible it is other than to wipe that out? Stimson was looking beyond the war. He was looking at post-war relations. His argument was, if we destroy Kyoto, we will make the Japanese so hate us that we will forever drive them into the arms of the Soviets. And we need Japan in our camp in a post-war environment. We're going to be the ones that are going to manage the occupation. Douglas MacArthur had already been selected at that point. We did not want the Russians in there. We wanted to manage it all ourselves. Mm-hmm. In fact, we didn't even have really any of the allies in there. It was going to be, we fought the war. It was ours to do. And we had a very set view on what we wanted to do there. And so that's the difference between Stimson and Groves on there. But Stimson is looking in that post-war thing. And of course, Truman is slow to grasp the reality of the rising threat in the coming Cold War. I mean, as he takes over presidency in April, he's getting these cables in from Churchill, talking about the Iron Curtains coming down, the Soviets, what's going on in Poland and other Eastern European countries where they're having influence. He's really slow to grasp that until he gets to Potsdam. And it dawns on him. He sees what the Russians want. He sees they want Hokkaido, and they're not necessarily anxious to surrender. They'll stop the war even after Japan's ready to surrender. So it dawns on him that Stimson had that longer, better view of it. That's an important part of it.
That Soviet perspective brings me to one of my favorite statements in your book. Quote, Moscow, as always, proved problematic. Let's get into that after one last short break.
As Scott elegantly describes in each episode of Beyond Barbarossa, the war on the Eastern Front was truly gargantuan, both in terms of its geography and its destructiveness. But given that there is so much territory to cover, and that so many millions of men were involved in the fighting, it's perhaps inevitable that some battles from the Eastern Front get overlooked. I'm David Sumner, and I'm the host of Europe at War, a weekly podcast exploring lesser-known battles and stories of the Second World War with a particular focus on the Eastern Front. From the drama of thousands of trapped German soldiers and terrified civilians attempting to break out of the Halba Pocket, to the unexpected and blistering counterattack launched by German forces on the Red Army during the Battle of Bautzen, many of the Eastern Front's most dramatic battles, particularly those which happened towards the end of the war, have long been neglected by historians, and their stories have remained untold. Until now. So to hear these incredible tales from the Eastern Front, and more, check out Europe at War, available on all podcast platforms. Thank you. Now let's get back to the show.
James Scott, there's a line in your book that really resonated with me.
Moscow, as always, proved problematic. And this was leading into the decisions to drop the bombs and so on. Can you expand on how problematic was Moscow in the summer of 1945?
Yeah, so what happens is Truman kind of comes in and he's sort of inheriting this relationship that FDR had managed. And he doesn't know a whole lot about it. He goes and finds Harry Hopkins, who had been FDR's very close aide, who had actually lived in the White House for a while, and gets Harry Hopkins to sort of tutor him on relations. And what you see is that the Russians are there's doubt as to whether or not they're going to join the United Nations initially. There are fear that they're not, which could be a huge death blow to that organization mm-hmm. that was really the baby of FDR. That was his sort of ticket to not having a third world war. Mm-hmm. So there's that tension there. There's, of course, Churchill's stress over what's going on in Poland, what's going on in Europe. As American troops are beginning to pull out of Europe and prepare for the Pacific, Churchill's going bonkers. The Americans are leaving. You know, the Great Iron Curtain is coming down, all this kind of stuff. And so Truman ends up playing a very heavy hand with Russian officials during this time because he doesn't know how to sort of massage relationships to the level that FDR did. So, you know, he ends up in these sort of browbeating contest, so to speak, with the Russian foreign minister and whatnot. And so, and he's ultimately successful, however, in kind of getting what he wants. He wants the Russians in the war. You know, he wants the Russians to ultimately come on board with the creation of the United Nations. They do. He wants the Russians in the war. He wants them in by a certain point. He gets that. But there's a lot of pushback at every step of the way. And I think when it comes down to the end, when they're being problematic there at the end, is that Japan has finally offered to surrender at this point. And basically, Truman is looking for somebody to just sign off on this. He sends it to China. Chiang Kai-shek writes back, congratulations. He sends it to the English. And of course, Attlee, who's now the prime minister, he's taken over for Churchill. He's like, go for it. You know, even Churchill, who's not even in power, cabling is go do it. And of course, then you got the Russians being like, we're happy if this kind of goes on for a little while longer. Yeah. And you know, basically what Marshall's saying is like, for them, it's kind of like a big smash and grab. You know, they're coming in there and they're grabbing up territory and things that they can get. And they're fine for that to go on for a while longer. Mm-hmm. And so he's got to once again kind of push back on that. Yeah. And I think that's kind of when you really start to see Truman understand the reality of that post-war relationship, sort of adversarial, our interests aren't lining up.
Right.
Yeah. It starts to really play out.
And it's not only that, there's just a different valuation on human life. And clearly totally. The Soviets weren't worried about losing a few 100,000 more personnel. We've already lost 20 million. That's a few hundred thousand more.
Human lives are huge for Truman. And that's everything for Truman. And that's one of the things that really I came to appreciate about Truman and doing this research was spending time in his personal papers, his letters, particularly his time from World War I, seeing how he was shaped by his experience in World War I. And then when you see that and you understand that, particularly when you look at like his letters before the war, when he's heading over to France, he's on the ship and when he's going through training, he's all excited like so many young men are. I mean, yeah, this is going to be a real test of my manhood and all this. Then he gets into the trenches and he gets out there and he sees human remains that are cut down. He sees bombs disinterring bodies. He writes back and he's, of course, spent the last decade on a farm, and which he's done everything he can to get away from this farm. Mm-hmm. You know, basically goes to war to get away from this farm. And he writes back, he's like, if I make it through this war, I'll be happy to spend the rest of my days walking behind a mule.
Right.
And suddenly that farm that he has run from becomes his utopia, his goal. And I think when you then see his discussion during the Battle of Okinawa, and as they're talking about the invasion of Kyushu, it makes more sense. His emphasis on, because he repeatedly uses this phrase for invading Japan, which is, I'm trying to prevent an Okinawa from one end of Japan to the next. And it's a phrase that's used a couple of times in that meeting. But Okinawa for him becomes synonymous of horror. And right. He's trying to prevent that. Completely different view from Stalin.
Right.
Just, you know, but for Truman, human life is paramount.
Yeah. And I think that really colors, or is maybe it's underpins some of the tension between the two main victors of this, of the war. Now, getting back to Japan, though, I mean, obviously after 1945, yeah, Japan is in the U.S. camp on the Western side and is to this day. But what was the impact then? What are some of the things that did actually change about Japanese culture in that time from 1945 to almost today?
Yeah, no, I mean, the Japan of today is a different place than the Japan of 1945. And that's what's important for people to remember. I mean, is Japan has transformed dramatically. Mm-hmm. There are certain cultural elements that are very uniquely Japanese that aren't going to change. But I mean, we effectively rebuilt Japan in our image over the course of a 7-year occupation. I mean, we transformed their government. Douglas MacArthur went after their industries. We tried to sort of take away the power of some of their big corporations, which were a lot of the drivers of the militarism. You know, hey, you want to be able to sell Zeros, you want to be able to sell tanks and bombers. And I think for the Japanese too was a real realization that the American occupation was benign, and more than benign, it was positive. And I think that it was such an early fear that had been propped up by the militarists of that the Americans are going to be horrible, that when the Americans come in and they introduce you to things like canned cheese and chocolate, and suddenly the war ends.
And cheese.
Oh, yeah. No, that's, you've talked to some of the Japanese people who will remember that. It's the little things. When you're starving,
yeah,
those are things that matter. That
to the Red Army, they really like, they love Spam. My father-in-law was in the Red Army, and yeah, that was when they started getting that stuff.
Spam, did you know Okinawa is still one of the largest consumers of Spam in the world?
Wow.
In fact, you go to Okinawa, it's everywhere. You can get Spam sushi. I've had Spam. Like, you know, when you go to like a Japanese restaurant, they sort of chop everything up and give it all. They do that with Spam there. The same. And I'll be honest, who doesn't love a little bit of Spam? It's really good. You know, like it's terrible for you, but it is terrible
you know, for you.
Japan really, as a result of that, it changes, you know, and you see it, the westernization of so much of things.
Yes.
And I'll tell you what's interesting is to compare Japan to is the Philippines, because there's a lot of bitterness in the Philippines, because the Philippines have been a former U.S. colony. Now, of course, remember Douglas MacArthur's whole thing, you know, I shall return, all that. And of course, you know, the thing that the Americans did at the end of the war is we granted the Philippines their independence and we said, good luck. And then we went and we rebuilt Japan. And every time I go to the Philippines, whenever I'm giving talks there, people, a question invariably always comes up is, why did the Americans rebuild Japan and not the Philippines? It comes up all the time. And it is
really
particularly because the Philippines was so decimated as well. And the Philippines had a 4-decade history with the United States.
Right.
Philippines is probably outside of the United States. I think it's the closest country. It's sort of in our image anywhere. English is the dominant language there. I mean, Tagalog is sort of their national language, but all the call centers for the United States are all headquartered over there. I mean, it's English is so dominant. Western culture is so dominant. Christianity is so dominant. It's also a product of Spain.
That is really interesting. Now, to bring it back to what my listeners are, I hope, interested in, it was only 4 years later that the USSR then detonated its first nuclear bomb. And that kind of brought in that, I hesitate to say, that was the day the Cold War started. It might have started far earlier, but it did lead to that. That's the beginning of that arms race and mutually assured destruction term. Do you think, though, that that outcome was inevitable after the bombings of Nagasaki and Hiroshima?
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, I actually think the Cold War started in Hiroshima. And that was the big fear of the Manhattan Project scientists, particularly Dr. Leo Szilard. I mean, he was preaching that we're going to set off this arms race and whatnot. And all of their predictions were pretty much spot on. I mean, you know, today we live under the umbrella of nuclear weapons. I mean, the whole reason America's fighting Iran is to prevent them from getting a nuclear weapon. I mean, Russia right now is threatening to use tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine. I mean, North Korea has a nuclear weapon is to prevent the Americans from coming over and having regime change. The Iranians are more set now than they probably have ever been about the fact that they need a bomb, because you know that bomb is it's a bat that you can swing against an intruder in their eyes. So that all starts there. And it's important for people to remember too, though, that like the atomic energy, it was coming. It wasn't like, oh, the Americans figured it out and suddenly we started this race. I mean, you have to remember the first atom split in the late 1930s in Germany, of all places. And really, the fear initially was that the Americans were behind in the race for atomic energy, that the Germans were really ahead, and that they were the ones headed there. There were over, I think, 100 scientific articles in the late 1930s written just about the potential for atomic energy and sort of what lay at the heart of an atom. I mean, so I like to tell people, like, to put that in comparison, atomic energy was sort of the AI of that generation. I mean, there was so much buzz around it, so much hype around it. The whole era of new physics was growing up out of it. Berkeley was starting whole programs related to it. The University of Chicago was doing it. There was just this buzz. So, like, everybody was doing it. And what it became is a race to be first. The Americans happened to win out because we had more money, effectively. And we also benefited from all the German scientists who fled.
Yes.
So the arms race was coming. You could probably even make the argument that it really started further back than even at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but there's no doubt that the first wartime use of a weapon like that sort of sets that thing in high gear. And of course, you know, one of the big arguments that was made, and one of the things I found so fascinating is in researching the Manhattan Project, is that when you look at the interim committee, and the interim committee was one of two major committees that were sort of set up in the Manhattan Project to study how the bomb was going to be used and sort of its post-war ramifications, is that these individuals were really, really smart. And they knew that at the end of the war, you would have to build an atomic energy commission. You would have to have legislation in place. You would have to build an international framework for how to handle this. I mean, these were smart thinkers that understood what was coming. And I think they all knew that after the U.S. dropped it, it wasn't like everybody else was like, oh, well, I guess they did it. We're done. I mean, I think everybody, it didn't take a rocket scientist, no pun intended, to figure out that, like, everybody was going to be scrambling.
The bombing and the development of the nuclear weapons really changed the nature of great power confrontation, because since 1945, the great powers of the world, the superpowers, have not directly engaged in warfare. There have been other forms of it, plenty of warfare since 1945 in the last 80 years. But what are your thoughts on that? Do you think it's
really
different?
No, I think you're totally right. And I think there was preparation for the possibility that we would have nuclear weapons on a battlefield and a tactical level. I mean, we were building artillery shells, like nuclear artillery shells. We were trying to build tanks that might be able to withstand strikes by them. So, I mean, I think there was preparation for that possibility that these would end up as being a tactical weapon. But what you subsequently see as sort of time goes on is that all countries have sort of taken a step back and realized nobody wants to cross that Rubicon.
Right.
Nobody really wants to be the one to use that. And I think you take a look at Vietnam, which is, you know, a war with 58,000 American casualties that goes on and on and on. It's a heavy conventional bombing campaign, which atomic weapons are never introduced. And what's been equally as fascinating for me in more recent eras, like watching what's happening in Ukraine right now, I find the advent of drones to be just one of the most incredible advances. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing to think that something you could get off Amazon, like an old school Radio Shack, is becoming this just huge transformation on a battlefield. I mean, I was reading an article just this morning in the Wall Street Journal about how the Russians are sort of like going around rounding up young men and forcing them to sign into the military, where these guys have life expectancies of days, if not hours.
Yeah.
They get out there. And it's like, gosh, just it's astonishing development. So.
Yeah. I guess it's debatable whether to call Russia a superpower today. The United States is still not, and China are still not directly involved, although they are very much involved in a more roundabout, indirect way through proxies or countries and agents that they support. I hope it doesn't escalate farther than that.
No, but it's been fascinating to watch and see. I watched a documentary recently, like looking at this battlefield through the lens of this 2,000-yard area, and just watching how the drones were playing out. Mm-hmm. And it was just fascinating. It's terrifying.
Well, just about done. I'll let you go soon, but I do want to ask two more questions. First, from Empire of Ashes, what's the most surprising thing that you learned in researching and writing this book?
You know, I don't know about surprising now, because I've been working on this book on and off for about a decade. But I think one of the things that sticks out that I think is important for people to realize is that over the last 8 decades, we've seen the question of use of atomic weapons in World War II become narrowed down to this yes, no, good, bad. Mm-hmm. It's a much more complex issue than that. And people don't bother with the nuance of what was involved in that decision. They don't understand what the battlefield looked like at that time, what the military complexities were like at that time, what the human logistics were and casualties were going to be. And so I think it's just sometimes you can overly simplify something and lose everything that's all about. And I think that's happened here. And that's why I would encourage people, if you read Empire of Ashes, I get into that a lot in the book. I think I try to explain what is going on from both the Japanese and the American perspectives. Mm-hmm. People have an idea that, like, this wasn't just some fly-by-the-night question, you know, yes, no. I mean, but that there was a lot of thought put into it.
Well, how I think, to use them all. I just point out the chapter where you describe the situation progressing in Japan itself through the war. By even 1944, there's severe food rationing, clothing rationing. People are asked to donate their personal items, their gold teeth even, whatever silverware they had, any cotton. So their clothes were made out of wood fiber and stuff. It just, and then just the lack of food too. I think that that's important to bear in mind, that if you're talking about just civilian lives lost, how many would be lost by extending the war another year? That's one of the things that I think, I mean, I knew about it, but to see it or to read about it in that level of detail makes a big difference.
That's a good point too. Thank you for bringing that out. Yeah.
My last question is, this book comes out at time of recording tomorrow, so it'll be a week or so before this actually hits the pod waves, but the book is coming out. That means it's a wrap. What are you doing next?
What's next? Well, I've got another book in the editing process now. So I do a whole series of books separate of World War II with Jack Carr, who's a thriller writer, retired Navy SEAL, in which we look at modern terrorism attacks that changed America. So we did one book, came out a couple of years ago, on the 1983 Hezbollah bombing of the American Marine headquarters and barracks in Beirut. And we've got a book coming out next April on the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland. Very emotional story, very powerful story, big tragedy. It's called Targeted: Pan Am 103, Lockerbie, Libya, and the Attack That Brought Terror Home.
Something else for you podcast listeners and aficionados to dig into in about 9 months' time. James Scott, thank you very much for your generosity and your time and present this story to us. Listeners, the book, again, is called Empire of Ashes, and as of time that this is released, it is available through all your favorite book retailers and e-tailers. Once again, James, I want to thank you very much for your help.
Scott, thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Take care.
And thank all of you out there in podcast land for listening to this episode of Beyond Barbarossa, the first podcast that focuses on telling the whole story of the Eastern Front of the Second World War. Once again, I put pictures and maps on the webpage for this episode. All you have to do to find it is go to beyondbarbarossa.ca. I also want to thank everyone who's supporting the podcast through Patreon. Next episode is going to be a look at another part of the Second World War that doesn't get very much attention here in the West, and that is the Nazi invasion and occupation of Norway and of the Norwegian resistance. I'll be joined by an author who knows a lot about this. So come back in 2 weeks' time. Until then, keep your podcast apps tuned to this channel, Beyond Barbarossa. Before you go, please make sure you click that follow or subscribe button on your podcasting app. And I'd really appreciate a rating on Apple or Spotify or Podbean or iHeartRadio or wherever you listen to podcasts. That really helps other people who might be interested in this part of history and who don't know about this podcast to find it. Do you have something to say, something to add, maybe pass on to James Scott? I love hearing from you, and I know that James would love to hear from you as well. So drop an email to scott@beyondbarbarossa.ca, or you can leave a comment on the Facebook Beyond Barbarossa page. You can also find me, Scott the writer, or Scott Burry author, on all the other social media like Blue Sky and Instagram and TikTok and Threads, everything except X, because X is terrible. Original music was composed and recorded by Nicholas Burry. That was Ragnar. I'm Scott Burry. Until next episode, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraina, vive le Canada!